Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Robert Jackson, who is the Chief Academic Officer of Great Hearts, which is a very successful charter school network in Arizona and Texas, many, many schools with a very long waiting list, big demand, even though you are a classical curriculum there at the in the high schools. But Rob, you are going to talk with us about a different project. So first, welcome. Thank you for joining us. And why don't you just tell us about, we'll just jump right in.
Okay.
Tell us about this new project.
Sure. Well, let me back up to say that it has been the success of Great Hearts Academies in, as you mentioned, Phoenix, which is where they were born. A mere prep school 15 years ago, numbering about 120 students.
One school,
Veritas Prep. And from that prep school, we discovered a real demand in that market among parents and families there in Phoenix.
And what was the draw then?
I think fundamentally it was a coherent curriculum. It was an understanding that curriculum is not divorced from pedagogy, or perhaps better said, the intellectual development is not to be separated from the moral formation. Great Hearts very much, as its name suggests, believes that minds and hearts are formed simultaneously. That the intellectual activity goes hand in glove, dovetails perfectly, right, with the development of the moral imagination, for example, when we read literature, when we study.
When I go to the ed schools, I don't hear the term moral imagination mentioned very frequently. What's going on?
Well, that's unfortunate, because if we were to go back 100 years, 150 years, when normal schools, as they were once termed, drawing on the French precedent, formed teachers, they knew well that literature, the study of history, the humanities generally, were fundamentally concerned with this moral imagination. I think sadly, in the past century, certainly several decades, we have found ourselves departing from that, because there's a sense that it's just about the utility of intellect, of academic skills, chiefly, can I get into college? Am I ready for a career? Right.
Right. You know, when I look at a lot of students, the ambitious ones, the high achievers, you know, if I think what you've given me is a term, because I've often found them smart, ambitious, motivated, do wonderful on tests, but there's something missing. And sometimes I refer to it as sort of bookishness. Someone has more sort of free-floating intellectual curiosity, but I think moral imagination may be a more precise term, because when they're faced with an assignment from literature, a difficult work of literature, you know, I was doing the Beat Poets yesterday, Kerouac and Ginsberg yesterday, I could see that those guys were steeped in the moral imagination. Now, I think they took it in the wrong direction, but they were profoundly interested in issues of redemption and the hazards of a utilitarian world. But this was pretty foreign to the education that these students have had, which is career oriented and about the implementation of knowledge toward advancement in some way. And I say, slow down, you guys. Let's let that imagination ponder for a minute. And I think this, we must see a lot of parents notice this. Something's missing. Even in the strong schools that don't emphasize this kind of classical moral imagination and cultivation, the formation of the broader person.
Clearly families, as I started to tell the story, are clamoring, right? Today, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, that's the punchline, right?
Yeah.
We started with those 120 students, three grades, 7 to 9, added a grade every year. But even within the first 2 to 3 years, there was this demand. More families learned of Veritas Prep, asked for an alternative for themselves, and within 7 or 8 years, we had an additional 5 schools, all prep schools, all formed around a Great Books curriculum that began in ninth grade, reading through the American experience, everything from the founding documents, right, to Hawthorne and Melville and Twain and others, so that was ninth grade, mm-hmm. that is ninth grade, and then working chronologically in reverse through the tradition back into antiquity, all the way back to the Greeks. So by the time a student reaches his or her senior year, they will be reading Plato and Aristotle, they will have encountered Virgil, they will read Dante, they are familiar with the literary tradition, broadly speaking, but they're also very philosophical in their outlook. That is to say, they think about higher things, they are concerned with matters of justice. And I was going to say a moment ago, as you were talking about your own students, right, at Emory, that those students today may not have been formed by schools with an emphasis on the moral imagination. I don't think it can be put down. It cannot be, apart from extreme circumstance, completely stifled. And so as I look around and I see the various social justice causes, my sense is that that generation you're referring to is still hungering, is still longing for purpose, that they are no longer driven or at least satisfied by climbing the corporate ladder and becoming organization men and women, right? So
right. And my concern about that is when I see the impassioned students, nonetheless, it is not a moral passion, a social vision that is sufficiently informed
by the great tradition,
the great books. I mean, if you want that, then you need to read Rousseau. You know, you need to read the visionaries of social worlds and the social thinkers. You need to read Rousseau. You need to read Marx. You need to read the progressives. You need to read Hobbes and the other.
And we do.
Which is, you're getting it. That's what you're giving them.
That's precisely right.
And your students are go to college. They are so much more advantaged than the student sitting next to them, who may be just as smart, just as skilled, but they don't have the background knowledge, so that when they are faced with a class that does some Abraham Lincoln, you've given your students the cultural literacy to absorb the Lincoln in a much deeper, richer way than the students who didn't get it.
I think that's right. It is the context, the cultural context. I mean, E.D. Hirsch talked about this decades ago now, and we have schools that are beginning to pick up on that. The classical schools are certainly of that ilk, but they go further because they are concerned with recovering a pedagogical and a curricular tradition, again, that points all the way back to our Greek forebears. And there is a continuity, not a univocal understanding of the tradition, because the tradition itself is dynamic, right? From Plato to Aristotle, we have this massive debate that's unfolding before our eyes. And so it does not, teaching in a classical vein does not require a kind of lockstep or dogmatic understanding, but rather...
And that was always a caricature.
And it is, sadly, still a caricature.
You face that sometimes?
Oh, we do.
In your discussions with school boards, leaders?
Yeah, school leaders or those who come to us, and certainly our critics will typically trot that out as the primary criticism. This is somehow, it's a total irony, right? The criticism is that these schools are elitist, that they're drawing on the West, and the West is clearly fairly narrow in its conception of the world. Again, the irony is that the West is anything but narrow. It is so capacious. Moreover, that by introducing our students to this tradition, they have far more resources, as you were just saying, to engage with the broadest possible set of ideas.
Exactly.
So they really are advantages, you say.
That the demand. I think this is extraordinary. And so Great Hearts, you're seeing the growth, and I mean we can continue talking about the academies, but. You were going to talk about the other project.
So I only wanted to give you that backstory we went from 120 kids. When I arrived 5 years ago, I came from a small liberal arts college here in Manhattan, the King's College, where I taught English and education courses. And when I encountered some of these students who were then in my classrooms from the Great Hearts Academies, I was struck by
So a few of them ended up here.
They ended up here in Manhattan, right, and at the college. They also then, in succession, introduced me to a headmaster who effectively used me as a recruiter, right, to identify some of my students who might be well-suited
teachers
for the classroom as teachers after they graduated. And I just couldn't send them enough because I believed in what they were doing. I do believe that that this form is precisely what is needed for a recovery of education. When I arrived 5 years ago to serve as their academic officer, they were 7,000 students being served by these schools, right? At the time, about 16, 17 schools. So we've grown immensely.
I thought grade books were old-fashioned, unpopular, uninteresting. Yeah. The world has changed.
The old is ever new, as it turns out, and is refreshing for these families, for these 7, students.
7,000.
7,000, that was 5 years ago. And so in the course of our expansion to a new state, San Antonio, Texas, as well as Dallas, we've now achieved a student population of 17,000.
Wait,
so it's 15
you're
years.
Kidding.
No, 17,000 kids.
And you've got a waiting list.
And we have a waiting list that's about the same number.
17,000. Now, are state legislators, are the chief state school officers of Arizona and Texas saying, my God, we've got to respond to this demand. We've got to expand.
We were very fortunate, and I'm certain it was propitious that we got started in Arizona because the charter laws were amenable. In fact, charter laws in Arizona have made it possible for Arizona to be the highest proportion of students being served by charters generally. They've given us the freedom, right, within that state. And Texas was similarly inclined. And so we were drawn to that state primarily because there was an openness and a receptivity. Mm-hmm. Specifically in San Antonio, the community came to us and to other charters and said, we need to do something for this locale.
Which means the traditional resistance, you know, from the teachers' unions or the school boards doesn't have any political clout.
Well,
not when you've got that many parents demanding this. The politicians, they respond.
We've had our share of encounters, right, with the political powers that be, and there is resistance, and as I mentioned to you earlier, there are certainly critics and those who would like to see this work go away. But we have a pretty good toehold now, and I expect we're going to be around for a good long time.
17,000. That's pretty good.
But to your question and to the project that we have taken up most recently.
Yes.
Our success and our growth is accompanied by a set of questions. At the top of the list are, how do we find enough teachers, qualified teachers, to staff these classrooms?
I was going to ask you that.
As we continue to grow, open new schools, we can't find enough. Last year alone, we hired approximately 380 new teachers. We're looking for folks who have a liberal arts background, who love children, love students, and who have a passion not only for their discipline, but for being able to convey that to the next generation. And these are also young people who, again, as I said at the outset, understand that intellect and moral formation go hand in glove. Without that, you're sort of disqualified. If you don't believe in that integration, you don't want to be, you know, teaching at a Great Hearts school.
Right.
So this demand for the schools, but the limiting factor of enough teachers has put me, as soon as I got on the ground in Phoenix, looking for partners in higher education. We were looking for schools, colleges, and universities that understand that K-12 education in this vein will need support, because the usual departments, think of schools of education and departments of education, they do not have an appreciation or really an understanding for this form. And I speak with some experience, having attended a large Research One university, finished up a PhD in education, and took probably one course, maybe two, where I really dug deep into the history of education. It begins somewhere around, you know, 1903 with a publication of one of John Dewey's volumes in many schools of education. It is a very contemporaneous and very ephemeral field in many ways in terms of the research and the literature. That's not what we were looking for. As I've just explained, this great books tradition and the pedagogy that's derived from that is not something that I'm going to find typically in education circles. Now, I'm hoping to change that, mind you. I'm hoping we will change it. And when I arrived 5 years ago, I went hunting for partner institutions, and I found a handful. Mm-hmm. So some you would recognize, like St. John's College, because of their Great Books curriculum. Mm-hmm. The University of Dallas has a very strong humanities center, a core mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. every undergraduate takes. And we found great alliance with their graduate school. And they are, in fact, the first, to my knowledge, the first university to step forward and offer a graduate degree to train classical school teachers. It was a degree in classical education. It looks at the history and the philosophy. It dovetails the pedagogy that is appropriate, right, yeah. developmentally for these children. I bet
their graduates instantly get two or three job offers.
Well, of course, we're placing them. Right. The first cohort was at least, I think it was almost all Great Hearts teachers that we put into their pipeline, 15 in number. I think we've had about 50 in total now over the last 3 years. Okay. But it's beginning to attract teachers from schools all around. Mm-hmm. That program was so successful for our purposes that we decided to spin off and do some things internally at Great Hearts that would draw on this resource of scholarship, right? Our friends, our colleagues in higher education. We hosted a symposium, which is to say a conference, about 3 years ago in Phoenix, where we invited three professor friends to come in and address us on three of the five canons of rhetoric. It was a topic we had chosen. It was something we were interested in exploring. And we wanted to do it well, to do it deeply. So John Briggs, Scott Kreider, Greg Roper all gave us, one of those three, from invention and development to style. We just had the time of our lives going after Aristotle, reading a modern primer on classical rhetoric. And then after discussing and having seminars, we would go into workshops where we began discussing, now what will this mean? This is headmasters, school leaders, and master teachers. What does this mean for our classrooms? Mm-hmm. How can we improve on the way we read great books and have students write and speak? Given the rhetorical tradition, what more do we need to do? Mm-hmm. Over the course of the next 2 years, we've now begun to integrate. So it was sort of a gestational, kind of intellectual.
How many teachers attend?
So for that first event, I think we had 120 or 30, something like that. Yeah. Small scale, we piloted it. The next year, 180, right? And that year we were into mathematics. So we were going to make sure the whole liberal arts got attention, and mm-hmm. we will continue to do so. But it dawned on us after these rave reviews from our school leaders and from master teachers, this is the best professional development we've ever had. Again, partners like the University of Dallas, like St. John's College, coming in, offering their scholarship while we think through the practice of how to teach 14 and 15-year-olds, and 8 and 9-year-olds, right? As we were thinking through this, it dawned on us, why are we keeping this to ourselves?
Yeah.
So the intent now, our purpose, is to begin taking these partnerships we've forged, developing an alliance. Mm-hmm. The term has sometimes been used of an ecosystem, right? This idea that if we are to flourish in K-12 classical education, we're going to need to have more support from outside. And so this past year, we put forward an institute for classical education that would build on these activities of partnerships in higher ed with scholars, fellows as I call them, with advisors, like yourself, who are speaking into the form, right, and into the questions that we have to address as K-12 educators, and eventually taking programming like the symposium, like this conference, and offering it to a much broader range of educators. Charter
schools. So this, your next meeting is this February?
It is, late February, 25th through the 27th.
And it's open to anyone?
It is. It is open because...
Well, let's go ahead and give the information for interested people who might want to register for the conference and attend. Where is it?
Easy enough, classicaleducation.institute. So all one word, this is the website.
Classical education, no caps, no punctuation.
That's right. Dot institute is the website. Dot institutes are now a thing. So classicaleducation.institute is in fact our institute. If they go there on that top tab, those tabs at the very top, they'll see symposium. First, they can just sort of browse and see what the institute's about.
Yeah.
I encourage that. But right there at the top will be the symposium. If they click on that, they will head to a separate website where they can see all of the speakers who will be present, our scholar friends, our practitioner friends, a number of folks who've been in the publishing industry that are targeting this classical market will also be present.
That's interesting, because if you've got some publishers showing up, if you've got some test developers maybe showing up, that's a sign the market is growing.
There's a real market.
The market is there.
There are, by my estimate, and these are rough numbers, I'm hoping to really tag this and make it a very tight statement within the next year, we're looking at well over 650 schools, between 200 or so charter schools that define as classical, and then another 450 or so defining themselves as classical in the private sector, mostly religious schools. 650 schools minimum, right, offering a classical form of education. There's a great deal of variety. I think I could identify some of the commonality, but across this United States, you're finding classical schools popping up everywhere. Charter schools in particular, classical charter schools, are the latest phenomena. And the average age of one of these classical charters, 5 years. They start with 500 students because obviously they have the support of state funding. They don't have to sort of scrimp and scrape as many private schools do just to get off the ground. But then they are able to launch, typically in the lower grades, and add grades as they go up into the K-12.
Now, your curriculum in the classical schools has a lot of religion.
In classical charter schools, there's going to be history, and therefore we are going to address the religious element, right? It's present.
But in literature, you're going to read a lot of religious writing, right?
You're absolutely
Augustine.
We read Augustine's Confessions. We read Dante, of course.
Do you read the Bible?
We do. We read sections of the Bible. Not entire, but yes.
Have you ever gotten questions about church-state issues? Because charter schools, we don't want any crosses on the walls,
right? That's right. And we don't have any crosses on the wall, quite honestly. Yeah. So
You couldn't get chartered.
No.
Right?
No,
if
that's
you
right.
did.
That's right. And it would really be foolish in many ways, because there is a value to this form of education, to this curriculum, that I think contributes to the common good. This is not an explicitly and certainly not a specifically religious enterprise. It's not Christian, it's not Muslim or Jewish, and yet all of those faiths are going to be touched upon in their context, right? We recover and discuss the tradition as it unfolds over time.
Right.
So let me say that these are public, they are secular schools, they're public charter schools, and they intend, with all their effort, to make clear that they are reconstituting or recovering a tradition that acknowledges the influence of family, of church and synagogue and mosque, of the economic systems, obviously the political regimes. All of that will be touched upon so that these young people come out with a very, a global vision, right, of the world. They can see the whole and not just the parts. That's important to us. And we think that that, in the spirit of the earlier term you used, that is cultural literacy of a form that we probably haven't seen in quite a while in America.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I'm on the board of the Core Knowledge Foundation, Edie Hirsch's project, and it's a curriculum, K-8 curriculum, and we, as Core Knowledge, we realize there must be a strong religious strand in the history and literature portions, but when we try to present the curriculum to school boards, they see that religion and they just get a little antsy. And it's not that they're anti-religious or anything, but they see we worry about litigation issues or someone complaining, and they just want to avoid trouble,
right?
Because they're political, they're bureaucrats, and it's nice to see that you get this integration of religion along with politics and military and all the other parts of the human reality, that no problem, not a problem. This can be done.
It can, and I think...
You shouldn't worry.
I think the Baudelaireized version, which may be safer, is in fact more dangerous. And what I mean by that is
that... It sounds like you're masking.
It not only that there's a masking, but when students will later encounter these things, we'll discover that religion, authorities, right, that have spoken to past generations are encountered with no, if a student has not been exposed to them, right, has no kind of bearings, if you will, in the world, I think that they're often susceptible to the fringe, right? To the extremist, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not even here thinking of extreme of any particular group, although there are obvious examples from recent history of young people who've gone off the deep end, right? Yeah. Who've become radicalized. I think in part, the form of education we are promoting helps to center and ground folks so that they can see that the extremists are just that. Right. They're on the fringe, that they don't represent the center, that they are in fact somehow disordered. And if there's one thing that we hope to produce in our schools, it's students who have a sense of the whole, as I said, and also a sense of that balance, right? That equilibrium of how to go forth in the world. I often reference the cardinal virtues. That's kind of an easy one to talk about. We're promoting virtue, human excellence in every sense. And a part of that means attending to one's soul, right? Attending to the necessary attributes or characteristics that are gonna equip me for life. If I'm not pursuing justice, if I'm not developing courage and temperance, ultimately, if I'm not becoming a prudent human being, I'm less than what I should be, what I was made to be. I feel like we're trying to produce a generation of prudent young men and women, right? By giving them this type of education.
Right. Well, the numbers speak for themselves.
Yeah.
Are there other activities that the Institute is doing? You're doing sort of the professional development seminar, the annual meeting. What else?
That's right. So we're going to be introducing publications. In fact, one's already out and about, and they'll see this. Anybody who drops by the website will see that Virtue, the title of our quarterly, is a fine package of art and articles and essays by a variety of folks. I'm going to solicit you shortly time to talk through the English curriculum at the university level. We're drawing on those scholar friends to tell the story in a very accessible, almost like an editorial essay. We're also profiling students and teachers and schools that are doing this well. We want to hold up exemplars, right, as the way that we move forward. This is for a lay audience, this magazine Virtue.
Yeah.
Within another year and a half, with the help from my scholar friends, I hope to put forward an academic journal as well. So we intend to get a conversation going of a rather high caliber that takes the activities of symposium, the conference, or any of these other PD activities and places them in hardbound copy that can be distributed to all of our classical colleagues across the country. That academic journal would be comprised of maybe 30% or 40% scholar contribution, and then practitioners, those in the schools who are trying to take a reading of Aristotle and introduce that to 15 and 16 year olds. Right? Yeah. Because there's some translation work that has to be done, as you can imagine, pedagogically, to go from the scholar's rendering, right, to what you can bring into the high school that's accessible. That's the kind of activity that the academic journal will promote, along with book reviews, right, the materials that are most helpful. Again, notes from the field, as it were.
Yeah.
So publications. The other two things, so we've talked about the symposium, publications, and I just want to distinguish that we have a number of fellows. These are scholars who have thrown their lot in with us. They come out, they provide instruction for our faculty, they write articles, again, of a scholarly caliber that are designed to elevate the discourse in classical education circles, right? To really, and as I said earlier, some editorial pieces that help families and others who may be interested to learn more. Mm-hmm. So you'll see on the website more of these things popping up in the course of the next year. It's a kind of PR campaign, if you will, right? To inform a broader public about classical education in the K-12 space. But there are two other things I wanted to mention. We are going to put forward an association at the national level so that both public and private schools that are identified as classical will have a place to go. Mm-hmm. For the public sector, for charter schools so dependent on state policies, we hope to begin doing some research and working with state legislatures and policymakers. This would be down the road, but by gathering together and identifying the players in a given region, a given state, we hope to influence the policymakers to produce laws and policies that are going to be more receptive, more amenable to classical education.
To do that, do you, in terms of approaching a state, do you go through the governor? You go from the top down? governor, chief state school officer, then down into local school boards and superintendents.
Yeah, I don't think there's just, I don't think there's only, there's not but one way, right, yeah, to skin the cat, as it were. When I talk to my colleagues in California, I think their approach is going to be different than my colleagues in Minnesota, right? They know the lay of the land. I don't profess, right? I'm not a policy wonk, and I don't know those respective regions well enough to speak with any authority, but I'm going to identify the players who are there, and we want to provide support to them. If they feel that an executive level, kind of gubernatorial approach is best, this of course depends on who's in office and who is supportive of charters, and specifically who might grasp a vision of classical education. Yeah. In the case of Arizona, we've had very favorable legislation. A number of legislators, including one of our own teachers, who is in fact a sitting legislator there in Arizona, Paul Boyer, has been very active. He sits on the education committee and has helped provide support and encouragement, right?
Yeah.
Teacher by day, legislator in between times, right? So
has Betsy DeVos policy, she's pro-charters, right?
Sure.
She's pro-opening up the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Has that had any effect?
Not for us specifically, no. But no. What I'm trying to keep tabs on now, and it's a lot to keep track of, is how this is affecting various states. Again, as we all know, it's that 10th Amendment, and it is the state's prerogative, right, to decide how they want to execute or how they want to provide education for the students of their states. I have yet to see, and as others have said, I think the Secretary of Education serves as a mouthpiece, a sort of a vision for what could be, mm-hmm. but ultimately, I think the experience of Great Hearts and others who've been at this work for a while suggests we're going to have to be have boots on the ground, right? We're going to need to have those who've been in the trenches bringing these schools into existence and find out what each state requires by way of navigating these policy questions.
Right.
I do hope we continue to have support, right, from the Department of Education, from the Secretary. But it's all going to boil down, you know, all politics being local. Certainly this politic is very much at the state level.
Well, all the trends look good.
Hmm.
Maybe we will, we'll see how we can spread the word on things, but maybe we'll have you back in a year,
good,
Rob, to talk and see where we are now.
That's right. Thank you.